Shweta Goswami is a doctor in Kansas City, and of course, she has political views of her own. But she cares for her patients regardless of their political leanings. So she was surprised when a patient dealing with terminal cancer got frustrated with a policy and asked her, out of nowhere,
"Is it because I was a Trump voter? And, you know, I saw him every day for a month and a half. And never once did I ever look at him and go, 'I think you're a Trump voter.' It just never crossed my mind. And so when he told me, it kind of came as a shock."
You don't have to be a doctor to relate to this moment, the moment when all the emotion we carry around politics in America enters into a situation that probably should not be political at all. But here we are, right? That person who perhaps we've demonized is sitting right in front of us, and it's our turn to speak. So what do we say? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And that's what we're going to talk about with two KCUR staffers who have been facilitating conversations across political divides in collaboration with StoryCorps since the summer. Ron Jones and Matthew Long Middleton. Hi, guys.
Good morning, Gina.
Good morning.
So we are going to hear what they have learned from that experience in just a minute. But right now, we want you to call with your stories from real life. How do you handle situations where political disagreement starts seeping into the discussion, whether it's over the dinner table, at work, online? Do you strive to find commonality? Do you stand your ground? Do you change the subject at all costs? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Ron, talk a little bit about how the project with StoryCorps worked. What inspired it and why Kansas City was chosen as a location?
Sure, Gina. Well, you know, David Isay, who is the founder of StoryCorps and the executive in charge, or CEO, so to speak, had this idea from an observation that our seemingly intensifying political divide was getting in the way of real conversations that were needed. So he came up with this idea to pit two strangers on different sides of the political spectrum to have a conversation about the origin of their values or beliefs.
The origin specifically?
Yeah.
Like, why do you feel the way you feel?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. As a way of providing a better understanding of where people were coming from. Because I think David's premise was, we do a lot of talking, but are we really listening to each other? So after raising, about $1 million to fund this project, they put out a request for a few stations to apply to be a part of this. And out of that application process, six stations were chosen. KCUR applied, and we were chosen to participate. And I think part of their methodology was to sort of spread this out as a way to achieve some geographical diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And so KCUR was chosen as a location, and we are very proud of that fact.
Yeah, it's cool. How many people ultimately volunteered to come do this, to come talk to someone knowing that they were not going to agree?
Well, we went through a process of contacting some organizations who could help us get the word out before we actually launched publicly. And from that effort and then our public launch of the project back in April, we were able to get almost 270 applicants to
262. I looked it up just before coming up.
Well, that's almost 270.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Matthew,
to be precise.
How did you paired people up? It's like kind of like a date. You were a dating app, but for...
I made that joke so many times with Ron because it really did feel like match. It really was. I mean, quite literally, it was matchmaking.
But so, not with the idea that they were like necessary. I mean, almost the opposite idea of they're supposed to get along.
Well, yes and no, right? Like, yeah, you're hitting the kind of tension there exactly, which is StoryCorps had already, when they had brought in these partner stations, they had already done a number of these conversations, you know, out in their own work that they do as a national organization. You know, and with other stations, just but like as their own thing. So they had some advice to give us about the process of trying to find these pairings. And they were suggesting things that, find some division between them, particularly like either beliefs or politically, but then also try to find some kind of commonality. So like maybe they're, conservative and liberal, but they're also both Roman Catholic, right? Like, and their faith is actually something that they mention is, something important to them, just as an example.
This is interesting because I almost feel like one of the places where political tensions can be the most profound and explosive are within families where theoretically people have so much in common, like being related.
Right, exactly. Or that, we grew up under the same house with the same set of rules and values, exactly. But there were some times, I'm thinking of one pairing I did with Kevin McAvoy and Amy Drake. Here were some of their commonalities that I thought worked nicely. Amy grew up conservative but became liberal, and Kevin grew up in a liberal house but became conservative. And moreover,
so they have a shared kind of journey.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Their journey's going, they essentially like cross paths ideologically. But the other commonality they had was that one of Amy's brothers was killed in September 11th, and Kevin grew up in New Jersey, and like he had, family that had worked on the two towers, and he like went to volunteer after September 11th. So they both had this deep connection there.
And you knew that before they had met each other.
Right. So yeah, we did a lot of work, Ron and I, because we had potential participants fill out a form, which was a bunch of questions. Some of them were like demographic information. But one of the things we were asking is like, are you religious? What, would you classify your religion as? And then we also asked them their political leanings, like, do you identify with a party? And, if so, how much? So like strong Democrat, neutral, all the way down.
Can I just jump in
say,
as I'm trying to translate this to ordinary everyday life, you have started the listening process for people in a way, which is really interesting. I mean, if we could stop as we feel our heart rates escalating in these moments and say, wait, I have a questionnaire.
Right.
I want you to fill this out. I'm going to fill it out too. We'll trade it. We'll see how much we have in common. And then we can pick right up where we left off.
Right.
Sort of like that.
Well, and I think you're also hitting on this other thing, which is, and maybe this is distinctly American, but, and maybe just humans. Like I think one of the things that this project did is really address someone's going to listen to me,
That expectation exists,
right,
and will be honored.
Well, and not only that, we all have deep emotional connections to these issues, and that, that they're, as a community resource, not to toot our horn too much, but the KCUR is here to provide you an outlet potentially, So one of the things that I liked about the way that Ron and I designed our questionnaire was we asked not just like what party do you affiliate with, if any, but, ideologically, how do you feel you fall within different categories? So like socially, and I think like there we put like, marriage equality, and then a few other examples, but then like delineating that between, very liberal to very conservative and anywhere in between. But then we also broke it up by fiscal policy and then also by like justice, like, death penalty, justice reform. And that was super interesting.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, because
as readers of that information.
Just as like raw data, it was, people would be like, I'm a very strong Democrat. But then they'd be like, but I'm pretty fiscally conservative, or, or I'm a strong Republican, but I feel socially fairly liberal.
Did you find that when you drilled down into details, there maybe was more agreement than you expected to find by just party affiliation? Or
yeah,
no?
Affiliation was almost like this own variable that kind of existed outside of, just because someone was a strong Democrat or strong Republican doesn't mean that they were like, well, I'm just super conservative, super liberal down the line. That people really, at least when they're thinking of themselves, and that's the other thing, that was a much more nuanced understanding of where they come
from. Right. And some of the applicants just chose not to identify with a political party. A few.
Mm-hmm. What was the hardest part about this for the people who participated in it, as far as you could observe or heard back from them?
Well, let me just jump in and say that, you know, Matthew and I did a pre-interview before inviting the selectees in. And then we sent them a participant packet, which gave them more detail, a better idea of what the project was about, along with some suggested conversation questions. And suggested was the operative word. You know, the conversation was their own. They could design however they wanted to. But we gave them some suggested questions. I think the hardest part was, you know, there were different levels of understanding about what we were after.
And that was hard, thinking about your expectations more than their experiences with each other. Well, you know, I want to hear a little bit of this. There's a lot of fear in politics right now. People on both sides, or all sides, if you see it that way, have something they're afraid of, something they don't want to happen. And so one of the conversations I really appreciated is the one where you had two people talking to each other about what it is they're scared of. Let's listen.
I'm scared of people thinking that Big Brother government is going to take care of them. And in every society in history where that mindset has taken over, it's led to tyranny. It's led to death and destruction. And in the most extreme cases, it's led to genocide. And I think that we're not only fiscally bankrupting our country, but we're morally bankrupting our country.
I'm actually afraid of hyper-individualism, that we will forget that it's community that sustains us, that we are responsible for each other. We're connected. Mm-hmm. We're all connected. And if one person is failing, then it's our responsibility to try to hold that person up.
So talk to me about this. Tell me about these people, Matthew, and what you take from what we just heard.
Well, there are a number of things that were going through my head. Ron was the one who facilitated that conversation. But it gets right at the really difficult nature of these conversations, which is like, yeah, someone is going to lose something, right? Someone is going to have to live an element of their fear. You know, if you were to go down one of those ideological avenues, right? And not to suggest like, either way, very, very hard to the left or the right. But someone there is going to live their fear. But what I loved about everything about their conversation was, did you hear how their tone was kind of just flat? Like that they're talking about something that scares them, you know, and they aren't letting that emotion of fear come pouring out. They're kind of like looking at it with gloves on. Sorry.
No. Something I kind of wondered about is that I think in the conversations I have witnessed exploding around these topics, it's usually when people are caught off guard. And the fact that everyone came in knowing that they were going to have this conversation maybe like had them not reacting and having suddenly like the hairs on their neck or standing up like fight or flight type situation.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were very clear at the outset that this conversation was not about a debate of, you know, of an issue or a political philosophy, but rather, again, trying to gain an understanding of how that person came to believe the way they do. And so we were at some points, not very often, but at some points during the course of these 26 interviews that we did, we were actually referees. So we'd call time out when the conversation moved toward a debate.
Oh.
Yeah. And that makes it much easier.
So have a referee, make plans, have a referee, have rules.
Exactly. Well, and we actually made
Have a whistle?
No, but and then there was like this other kind of like, and this is perhaps a little too much, as a metaphor to inside baseball, but there were times when people were so eager to find areas of commonality that the conversation was almost like, well, Okay.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree, Ron. That's great. You know, like, Exactly. Yeah, we shouldn't all do X. We shouldn't all do Y. Okay, great.
Okay, so this brings me to kind of a downer of a thing to ask, because I know that your goal here is to help people come together, but is it also arguable that maybe these disagreements can be real and profound enough that getting past them for the sake of warm fuzzies is not always realistic and maybe is not even always ideal?
Well, let me attempt to answer that question by just letting you know that one of the questions we asked pretty often in these 26 interviews that we facilitated was we'd had these little cards prepared as a way to keep the conversation flowing.
Yeah, because that was another thing. Like, yeah. People, it was kind of a crazy realization for me. I'm sorry, Ron.
No, go ahead.
Was that I realize even in myself how trained we have become by what we see as political discourse. I'm using air quotes right now that you can't see. That, like, you know, everything we see is, no, I need to take a stand. I need to make it like. We haven't practiced this kind of conversation frequently, and it, moreover, with a stranger, it's even harder. So we developed these conversation cards to help people out because these kind of conversations don't typically happen in your normal life. Right.
And one of the cards was, is there anything that you heard me say during this conversation that changed your mind about anything? And quite often the answer was no.
Well, so, but that does... I guess where I'm coming from on this is partly there are issues that people feel strongly about because of how deeply that issue affects them personally on a really deep, deep, deep level, that they might feel threatened in their safety even by a political position that they oppose.
Oh, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. guns. Abortion, it's like. Civil rights / Black Lives Matter. We had these conversations frequently and like at the outset of this because, yeah, and this is kind of the challenge of this call out culture that we're in the midst of. And I'm using call out culture, even though it's usually associated with the left. I think that, you know, the idea of it, of instant escalation, is something that both, you know, all sides of the political spectrum.
Well, I think
are
of
falling.
It as instant labeling,
yeah, that
and
too.
Then shutting down,
right? Because, but in the context of, you know, just for an example, like microaggressions, right? That this is, even though the infraction is, you know, we call it a microaggression. It's in the context of an understanding of racism that's like. There's systemic global racism, and we had to address that. And so to give any ground on that makes you complicit in racism. So how do you get around that? And that's where these conversations really kind of shined, because people were able to not jump over each other.
Call 816-235-2888 to join this discussion with KCUR's Ron Jones and Matthew Long Middleton. They organized Kansas City's One Small Step Conversations with StoryCorps. 816-235-2888. We want to hear your stories when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're hearing from Matthew Long Middleton and Ron Jones. They're my colleagues here at KCUR, and they got people who disagreed in some crucial way to sit down together and talk. Sounds simple, but with things as tense as they are right now in public discourse, it's not simple at all. Or is it? Or is it? Hi again, guys. That is my question. Or is it?
Matthew? It's hard.
Yeah, it really is challenging. And yeah, like, right. And I struggled with this too, because there were people who were, we had one of our first conversations, I'm trying to remember who was between, ultimately we didn't choose to broadcast it, but, younger man from UMKC who helps out with the member of the Young Republicans Club there was talking about after the election, he was telling his conversation partner that there were people who came in masks and, you know, he identified them as a number of people of color who would shut down their meetings, particularly when they had chosen certain speakers to come and talk. So that, you know, there were people protesting, disrupting his gathering of, you know, young Republicans at UMKC shortly after the election. And it was interesting because, you know, when I heard him talk about that, it was like this really difficult situation, which is like, you know, you can very easily understand how he felt threatened and, you know, that his ability to explore ideas was undermined. But at the same time, you know, like there were serious grievances and things that, you know, these other students really wanted him to inspect. And I just left from this whole thing about like, well, you know, how do we move forward? I mean, I was really happy in that instance, he was telling
me. What is one small step in that situation?
Yeah, exactly. But there was this feeling ahead. It's like, oh, I really wish I could have found one of those protesters who shut down his meeting, because what would that interaction be like if one person wasn't protesting and or wearing a mask and another person and he was there to actually talk about what's hurting each of them. And you were saying like other tips for having these conversations. We never did anything more than two participants at once. And I can only see it devolving the moment you get more people involved.
Yeah, because then there's the audience.
Yeah.
Right. Right. There's anticipated grandstanding, so to speak. You know, we also had a couple of recorded conversations with young people, high school aged people. The Interfaith Youth Council helped identify some young students who talked about basically about religion and their particular ethnic beliefs, so to speak.
And they were so bright.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very much woke high school students.
To use the terminology.
Yeah, to use the terminology.
Sorry.
No, go on.
I was just going to say that, like, it was very exciting. Like, I think what you're asking is, was it worth it, right? Like,
well, or are there things that you can take from this in conversations that have not been facilitated by someone else? Do you leave this experience of having done this for a while changed conversationally because of it, or empowered to make connections where it might have otherwise been difficult? I mean,
on a personal scale, you're saying? Yes and no. I feel that there were things I noticed as a facilitator. I was like, oh, journalists are really good at this already, because it's, you know, it's been our jobs for so long to think about how will the other side interpret it if I say something like this. So for me, it was just more practice doing what I'm used to doing. But I do think that reminding people to turn that part of their brain on to just for a second, not say that the other side is right, but to just for a second, maybe assume that also you may not be right. And taking a moment to explore that with another person and to think about, well, what has informed that position in me? What experiences have happened to me? I think is really helpful. That's like the biggest thing. Talk about like a story. Pinpoint that moment where your mind changed or your mind got solidified. Like, that is right, that is wrong. What was that moment that really formed that for you?
Yeah, that is really difficult. I mean, it's difficult to admit to yourself that you were wrong about a particular stance that
or
you
might
took.
Just possibly not be 100% right. Even that is kind of hard.
It is
Let's
difficult.
Admit it.
It is difficult. You know, I was hoping for that moment in these conversations. I don't know that we really discovered that.
No, I don't know sure we did, but there were I'm trying to think of I think there were times when in the process, and I think this is what David Isay at StoryCorps was really hoping, that like storytelling would lead to this. It wasn't that people changed their position, but they understood how they got there, because I do feel that that's kind of what we've missed. Is like, I can't even begin to fathom how you could say, you know, that, you know, abortion is legal, or that, you know, I can't even fathom that you're not giving a woman a right to choose what happens to her body, right? Whatever the issue is, we can't even understand how they get to that position. And
whichever position it is on it, each side of a charged
question. And I think because it becomes like something so out there.
Well, Matthew Long Middleton, Ron Jones, thank you both so much for the work you've done and for sitting down and talking with me about it today.
Well, thanks for having us, Gina.
Thank you.
You can hear all the StoryCorps conversations that they worked on and that we aired as part of One Small Step at KCUR.org. Up next, My Fellow Kansans with Jim McLean on KCUR's Central Standard. Stay with us. Rural Kansas is dying. That was the headline of an article in the New Food Economy last year. And it ticked people off. But is it true? Jim McLean is a Kansas native. He's from a small town in the southeast corner of the state. He read that article last year. He heard the pushback, and he decided it was time to set out and see for himself how rural communities are really doing today. That's turned into the second season of the podcast My Fellow Kansans from the Kansas News Service. We'll be listening to it weekly on Central Standard this fall. Here's Jim McLean with Episode 1, Season 2.
Corey Brown grew up in Kansas, in Wichita, but her career as a journalist took her away from the state to more populated and largely more prosperous places. Recently, her job brought her back and gave her a chance to travel the state's back roads.
It's a beautiful place. I had mornings when I would be driving at dawn, and it took my breath away.
I've had that experience.
Every corner, every segment of this state, which I had never done, even as a kid. And there were so many things that I hadn't seen before.
Brown came back to pursue a story about farming and food and found a place more emptied and gloomy than she remembered.
It wasn't what I came looking for. I didn't think that's what I was going to find.
The continuing march to more efficient farming that she found upon her return, more acres being farmed by fewer people, has sped the hollowing out of parts of the state, a trend that began well over a century ago when Congress's passage of the Homestead Act enticed thousands of settlers to stake claims and start plowing up the prairie. But it's a trend that's been picking up speed in recent decades.
You know, it's not like this is something happened and it's going to correct itself. It's a trajectory that is only going to become more and more dramatic.
Brown sees Kansas, at least its rural expanses, as a place virtually doomed to wither away. Outposts with a storied past, but no future. Yet many who remain in the state's small and shrinking towns push back. They see something, a way of life, a community, a family farm that can be saved, maybe even revived. We're here to talk about where the truth lies. I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service.
There's three questions that we want you to address tonight.
That's the Lieutenant Governor of Kansas, Lynn Rogers. Like lots of politicians before him, he's looking for ways to bring prosperity back to places that keep getting smaller and, for the most part, poorer. At each of the places he stopped during his recent quote-unquote rural prosperity tour, Rogers posed the same three questions.
The first one is, what is prosperity? How do you define it? The second question is, what are you doing right? And then the third question would be, what stands in your way to prosperity? Maybe it's local, maybe it's state, maybe it's national, maybe it's attitudes, whatever. We need to hear from you in those regards. But let's go ahead and start up here. If we had somebody that would volunteer, you don't necessarily have to.
And then I think probably a common thread through all rural communities is the failing infrastructure, whether that be roads or sewers, water, buildings. I think that's, there's a lot of money that has to be invested to maintain where we're at.
All right, thank you very much.
I'll focus on the ideas coming out of those listening sessions in the coming weeks. I'll also highlight work being done by the new Kansas House Committee on Rural Revitalization. Republican Representative Don Heineman, a farmer from Dighton, chairs that group. It's looking into what the state can do to help rural communities address some of their biggest challenges, things like high-speed access to the internet, affordable housing, and health care.
It's a difficult challenge. It's frustrating because we are limited to some extent in the amount of success that we can have. But it's imperative that we try and do what we can to bend the curve of declining populations and declining economic activity.
Generally, I think it's safe to say that expectations for both Heineman's committee and the initiative Rogers is spearheading for Democratic Governor Laura Kelly are modest. Inspired partly by Corey Brown's view that rural Kansas is a glass half empty and leaking, I decided to take a fresh look at the state that's always been home to me. I spent my formative years in Parsons, a city of nearly 10,000 in southeast Kansas, and that's a corner of the state that's struggled for decades as coal, lead, and zinc mines petered out, sometimes leaving Superfund sites behind, and as good-paying railroad and manufacturing jobs evaporated. As a State House reporter for more than 30 years, I've watched rural lawmakers scramble to stop the depopulation of their districts, the boarding off of their main streets, the consolidation of their schools, and the closing of their hospitals. So when I read Brown's article, it seemed generally on target to me. But the Kansan in me wanted to see if she had missed something, if she had overlooked reasons to be more optimistic. While some communities seem to have given up the struggle, not every place is doomed. To have a fighting chance, communities must have a core group of smart, energetic citizens willing to step up over and over again to meet whatever challenges come their way when it can be so easy to give up. And they need help from the outside, money from state and federal taxpayers to help pay for essential things that their shrinking tax bases can no longer deliver: roads, schools, safe drinking water, and health care. But getting back to Corey Brown and her travels through the state, she came to investigate how Kansas, the nation's breadbasket, could end up with food deserts, places with no grocery store and no easy access to fresh produce, and sometimes places where you have to settle for a slice of Casey's pizza instead of a made-from-scratch meal at a local cafe. That didn't make sense to her until she got here.
As I'm driving around to these small towns, I realize there's no one here. This isn't about a food desert. This is a people desert.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I had to sort of recalculate and recalibrate what's happening here.
Brown's article came out last April, headlined, "Rural Kansas is Dying." I drove 1,800 miles to find out why. The answer is revealed in a subheadline that reads, "A native Kansan returns home to find that the broken promises of commodity agriculture have destroyed a way of life." Put another way, the small and medium-sized farms that for decades have sustained rural communities and a way of life are getting gobbled up by big farms that need to get even bigger to survive. And because of new technology, more sophisticated tractors and combines, GPS mapping systems that improve both efficiency and crop yields, it takes fewer farmers to work those bigger farms. There were 135,000 farms in Kansas in 1950, average size 374 acres. Since then, the number of farms has dropped by more than half, to roughly 58,000. But the average size of those that remain has more than doubled to nearly 800 acres.
It's not that there's less acreage being planted. It's planted within an inch of its life, and it's growing tons of crops. It just doesn't require very many people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I didn't appreciate, is how few people you need with the kind of mechanization that we have now.
Those changes and others, brick-and-mortar groceries and hardware stores put out of business by Walmart and Amazon, accelerate depopulation, an old trend picking up speed. More than half of Kansas's 105 counties average fewer than 10 people per square mile. Brown's so-called people deserts. They're created, she argues, by a modern farm system that coerces farmers into growing wheat, corn, cotton, and soybeans in slavish devotion to fickle markets that often fail to pay even a break-even price.
Corn and wheat futures sharply lower after the long three-day holiday weekend.
The initial report reaction was to the downside, but after a few minutes of digestion...
1032, the out months, though, lower.
October Friday afternoon. All the primal cuts were reported lower. Lean hogs for October.
So when I was driving around, there were mountains of grain piled up next to the grain elevators that were full to bursting because prices were down and everyone was hanging in there hoping that prices would go up just enough, just a little. I mean, it's just whatever the price is at that moment in time is what you get paid. Doesn't matter how high the protein levels are in your wheat. Doesn't matter how good you were at limiting your fertilizer use to do right by the land. None of that stuff comes back to you in a higher price for your goods.
And so it discourages people, some of those farming practices, because really the name of the game is to grow as much as you can, because it's a volume business more so than anything.
Right. That's the only thing you can really try to control. But then everyone's doing a bang up job of growing more and more of this thing that has a commodity price. So that depresses the price. So the better they are, the more effective and efficient as they are at growing those crops, the lower the price goes.
And that's the irony you found, that Kansas farmers are as successful at what they do as they ever have been. But that's not necessarily a good thing.
Correct. And what's interesting about it is that, you know, it's not like this is something happened and it's going to correct itself. It's a trajectory that is only going to become more and more dramatic. And there's going to be less and less need for schools and less need for banks, less and less needs for all the other things that support a community. I couldn't find anyone in leadership saying, okay, how do we rationalize the world of rural Kansas? How do we help people? I mean, there's no broadband strategy. There's nobody with a great idea for broadband out there pushing it. I couldn't even find anybody who could tell me what it would cost to roll out broadband across the state. They hadn't done that fundamental work. Nobody is taking this depopulation seriously. And then it hit me. They just have accepted it. I think they're supposed to be doing something to
change the trajectory.
And what is actually happening is everyone is accepting it as rural Kansas is going to die.
You didn't find anybody out there who's, you know, engaged in this kind of Don Quixote-like fight, you know, raising their fist against all these forces, saying, no, we need to stop this trajectory.
And there were plenty of people who didn't like my story. Okay. And I heard back from them saying, you don't understand. We're fighting the good fight and we're doing fine. And they were from towns that I knew and had been in before that have lost a third of their population in the last generation. And they're on track to lose another third. They were completely in denial. Their main street had no shops in it. And they said, but we've moved our shops and all of our businesses into our homes, so we're doing fine. It's like, that's not doing fine. That's just dying a little slower.
Brown's article touched a nerve, particularly with people in the trenches, those fighting the trends and working really hard to make their communities more attractive to the young people they desperately hope to hang on to, or failing that, to someday entice home.
But there was so much good that didn't even make the article. That's what kind of was misleading for me. I was hoping it'd be more of a objective article.
Rural Kansas is going to survive because we do have that sense of pride in our communities. We're not going to let them die.
If you're looking for the negative, that's very easy to find.
I wanted to see for myself, so I hit the road. First stop, Phillipsburg, a town of 2,600 on the high plains near the Nebraska border, directly north of Hayes. It's a gorgeous part of the state. Driving through the region's chalk hills at dawn, pastures of golden grass stretch through the valleys to the horizon. More than once, I was tempted to pull off the road, get out of the car, and take it all in. But I needed to get to Phillipsburg in time to catch up with the Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you very much. This is exciting. Phillipsburg knows how to turn out, and I know we've got folks from Hayes and Stockton and all different parts in between.
Rogers held a dozen of these meetings around the state. At each one, he asked those same three questions, an exercise aimed at pinpointing what's wrong and generating ideas about what might make things right. Modest expectations aside, one of rural Kansas's biggest boosters says any increased attention to the problems of small communities is welcome.
It's just great to be listened to. I mean, just that means something to us.
Marcy Penner runs the Kansas Sampler Foundation from a small complex that resembles a barn just outside of Inman in the middle of the state.
Hey, Jim.
Hi, Marcy. How are you?
I'm good.
You may already know about the foundation's guidebook. If not, it's definitely worth checking out. 480 pages of otherwise hard to find, sometimes arcane, but at least to me always interesting factoids about virtually every community in the state. It covers everything from the Cowpatty Golf Course near Grinnell to the collection of artifacts and personal stories from Kansans who endured the Dust Bowl at the Adobe Museum in Ulysses. Celebrating small victories in rural Kansas is Penner's passion, her life's work. She concedes that Brown's article reveals some hard truths, but she thinks it gives short shrift to the almost heroic work being done to keep small communities alive.
I think it's easy to do the story on how rural is dying. I think it's harder, to find the positive parts, but they're there.
Maybe so, but the big picture doesn't appear to be all that positive. Almost two-thirds of Kansas counties peaked in population before the Great Depression. Many, says historian Virgil Dean, long before that.
There are certain counties, quite a few counties, that peak in the 1890 census in terms of total population and never recover.
To this day.
Mm-hmm. Some peak in 1890, and then they recover to a little bit higher level by 1930, and then they've never reached that level again. In some cases, it's real dramatic.
And like people, good jobs are scarcer than they used to be. That means more rural Kansans are living in poverty and without health insurance. The rural poverty rate is inching towards 14%, much higher than the rate in the state's urban areas. The story is roughly the same throughout the Great Plains, that middle tier of states that stretch from Canada all the way to Mexico.
If you just look at the statistics, that's, yeah.
It paints a certain picture.
It does. It paints a certain picture, but you can't look at these towns as statistics. I just think if you're looking for the negative, that's very easy to find. But I'll fight for these towns every day because there are young people moving back. There are good things going on. It just might not look like what you're used to for what success looks like. And we're just all busy trying to repurpose our small towns. And it takes energy and you get tired and you get excited and you need a clubhouse and you need each other.
Penner and Wendy Rowe, her life partner and the assistant director of the foundation, have created a virtual clubhouse. They bring Kansans who somewhat defiantly proclaim themselves rural by choice together in lots of ways. They organize duologues, gatherings to which only people ready to solve problems are invited. And they crisscross the state, handing out We Can Awards, that's can with a K, to unsuspecting people who Penner believes are difference makers. Corny, maybe, but Penner's been doing it since 1994, and the recognition definitely means something to those who get it.
We are about to go in to the kettle to surprise Bee and Mandy with a We Can Award. Come on.
Husband and wife Bee and Mandy Fincham own and operate The Kettle, a combination coffee shop, cafe, and wine bar in Beloit.
Okay, go.
Where's Bee?
I wonder why you...
Bee Fincham teaches at Beloit Elementary and helps out after hours in The Kettle's kitchen. Mandy Fincham runs the business. She gave up a good job as an economic development grant writer after convincing herself that Beloit, a town of about 3,800 in north-central Kansas, needed and could support a gathering spot. Someplace nice to meet for breakfast in the morning, a good cup of coffee pretty much any time, or join friends for a glass of wine or craft beer in the evening.
Beloit, you are a lucky town to have these two here. And you know, Bee and Mandy, if your town didn't appreciate you, they wouldn't all be here. So, what we would like to do, this is a We Can Award to Mandy and Bee Fincham. The name of the award is for giving Beloit a cool factor. And that's what this place is. There's so many towns across the state that would do anything to have a place like this. Boy, yeah.
The We Can Award, stoneware fired from Kansas clay featuring the sampler logo, is prominently displayed among photos of musicians who have played at The Kettle on the wall opposite my table as I sit down for breakfast and to chat with the Finchams.
Bea and I are big social people. We love to go out and talk to people. We love to be a part of the community. And we also love a good craft beer or a glass of wine. We love coffee. We had kids, and we wanted a family-friendly place where you could still have an adult beverage with some live entertainment and feel comfortable bringing a 3-year-old or a 12-year-old in here. So we didn't have a place like that in Beloit. So we did a little bit of research, and the more research we did, we realized that could work. So we just thought, we don't want to be 80 and have regrets. So we decided to try it. And so far, it's been great.
And you've made a pretty big business gamble here in a small community. And so what's your view? Is the glass half empty or is it half full when it comes to rural communities?
Well, I think Beloit is quite the gem. It's got a fantastic school system. It's got a fantastic hospital. It has a lot of 20, 30, 40-year-olds with growing families. And I can't speak for the rest of rural America, but I know Beloit is a special place, and it needed a special place like Kettle.
And Bea, what do you have to say about that?
I think the glass is what you make of it. And I think here in Beloit, it's half full. And it takes things like Kettle and people like us to make it half full and to continue filling that glass.
Our main goal is having fun in life. So we made fun. We brought the fun to Beloit. We're big proponents of the Kansas Sampler Foundation, and Marcy Penner was so generous to award us a We Can Award for bringing fun to Beloit. That is what we're all about. That might sound shallow, but we like having fun, and we want to have other people around us have fun.
But could you do this without your teacher salary?
Absolutely not. No, we couldn't. We need some stability, because as much fun as this is, fun is not always stable, and it's a roller coaster. You know, rural Kansas, a smaller town. We don't have the populace to be consistently, you know, super busy and super full, of customers. So my salary needs to offset all the fun.
Well, thank you both for spending a little time with me. Now it's time for breakfast.
Yes, absolutely. And coffee.
Thank you.
Thanks.
A hip coffee shop stands out in a small town. It creates an urban sensibility, a kind of rural cool. But how much can it really do to prop up a town hit hard by depopulation and everything that goes with it? Well, that depends. Research being done at Iowa State University, led by rural sociologist Dave Peters, confirms that communities really can't do much on their own to reverse decades of population decline. But they can maintain a quality of life that makes it more likely that people will stay or someday come back. That is, if there are people in the community, particularly young people, like Bea and Mandy Fincham, who are willing to step up and make things happen. Peters says they can be the difference between a shrinking but still livable town and one that has given up.
And that's really what it takes. It takes, you know, you need a lot of people to step up and take a leadership role. It's not going to happen otherwise. You know, you don't have large city governments. It needs to really come from citizens and residents.
But the forces threatening rural communities can overwhelm the most determined efforts to counter them. Former Governor Mike Hayden grew up on a family farm near Atwood in northwest Kansas. And he's among those who have reluctantly concluded that the trend toward bigger farms and fewer farmers is, in large part, driving the exodus from rural Kansas.
Well, we've had the same farm for 104 years. We still have it. And the truth is that it's more productive today than it's ever been. And in 1960, there were 17 people in our family whose major financial support was that farm. 17 in 1960. Today, there are 3 people.
From 17 to 3. That says a lot about Kansas farming and the future of towns that sprung up to support it. We'll talk about how industrial agriculture is changing rural Kansas and what can or should be done about it next time on My Fellow Kansans.
My Fellow Kansans comes from the Kansas News Service, a statewide public radio collaboration. It's hosted and written by Jim McLean, with production help from Scott Cannon, Suzanne Hogan, Ben Stanton, Beth Golay, and Luann Stevens. We'll be hearing season 2 of My Fellow Kansans on Central Standard next week. Episode 2 of season 2 next week. Tomorrow, a special documentary on KCK natives working to reimagine and revive a historic boulevard, Quindaro Boulevard. We're on Twitter if you want to talk. We're at KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.